Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
You're listening to WORT FM Madison.
Are you excited to get out and see some great live music while wiggling your toes in the grass? Do you yearn for delicious food and a cornucopia of local brews? Craving the whimsy of browsing local crafts or creating your own artwork? Are you ready to usher in the summer music festival season? Then get to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th for Wartstock, presented by WORT and Union Cab of Madison. Check out this great lineup. At noon, Son del Atlantico ignites the day with hot Afro-Colombian flair. At 1:20, Strings to Rome brings lively bluegrass and folk. At 2:40, Blue Stem Jazz unleashes undisclosed Sims from Chicago. At 4 is Roscoe Foster and the Rascal Theory, ready to funk things up with their mix of rock, blues, funk, and soul. The Forward Marching Band will rouse the crowd into some good old sing-along fun before Boiled in Lead tops off the day at 5:30 with their Twin Cities-based Celtic Sound. This year also marks the 20th year of No Crap on Tap. Madison Homebrewers and Tasters Guild is providing an ever-changing cornucopia of fine local beverages from more than 20 local breweries. More information is on our website at wortfm.org. Wartstock is proudly sponsored by Union Cab, along with Summit Credit Union, Dane Arts, MG&E Foundation, Madison Homebrewers and Tasters Guild, Hoyos Consulting, WSUM 91.7, and Blue Stem Jazz. See you there!
The following program is syndicated. Please excuse any dated references. You're listening to WORT Madison.
Welcome to the Bowery, working, parenting, playing, voting, advocating, and creating as women.
Looking into the mirror, I did not see me. This is me. But as me gradually began to surface, like coming to the surface of a dark pool of water, I began to say, yes, this is me. Whoever this is me.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Identity is complicated, yet many people never have to think about it. We form our identity in combination with our genetics, the circumstances of our birth, and the culture we're raised in. For cisgender women today, our identity as women is seldom in question. Modern women know that they can simply be women, whether they choose to marry or not, whether they choose or are able to mother or not, whether gay or straight, working in traditionally female professions or not. My guest, on the other hand, had to look in that mirror and search. Let's meet her.
Hi, I'm Sandy Stone, and I'm chief engineer for KSQD, first of all. I'm a recovering academic. I'm emerita from the University of Texas at Austin. I'm a performance artist, an author, a computer programmer, and just a general idiot about town who likes to raise hell and get into trouble. And that's probably the best summary I can give. And who likes good chocolate and is always hunting for it.
Sandy Stone is now in her 80s, a community elder respected for her work in sound engineering, academia, and performance. Now she is a fully realized human being. But as a young adult, she built her identity literally out of nothing. When she looked in the mirror, she had to construct what she was seeing because there were no women like her, no role models to help her understand herself. She is a self-described geeky kid who didn't fit in, a person out of time searching for an explanation, a transgender woman who didn't even have the vocabulary to describe herself. In the first part of the program, we'll learn about her childhood, much of it spent in the imaginary world of Girl Island. In the second part, we'll explore her early adulthood, transition, and career. Finally, we'll talk about what she has learned about gender, how she sees young people, and the concept of womanhood today. We started by going back to Sandy's earliest years in the 1940s, to a Jewish boy in New Jersey who had no idea who he was and why he was. So much of the current conversation makes a lot of assumptions based on the way things look now. But things looked very different when you were young. So can you talk a little bit about your childhood and, you know, starting with, did you know that you were transgender? Or I know a lot of trans people describe it as just feeling different, not knowing what it was. And what were the functions of women in your lives? How did you see women then?
That's a lot of questions in one.
It is.
There's the thing about feeling different. That's the way that a lot of people describe it. I would describe it that way too. You don't really have a language, either verbally or symbolically, for what's going on with you. But in my case, it took the form of wanting to hang out with, if I may use that term, little girls. And at that age, I'm not sure that there's any scientific reason for believing that anyone understands the difference between, quote, little boys and little girls. You're just living in your environment and things are happening and you're trying to make sense out of them. Later on, when I look back at that, I had a model for it, which might actually have been what I was thinking at the time. I had a magical place I went to called Girl Island, which was inhabited entirely by girls, but the girls were doing, we're talking about 4 or 5 year old, very small. The island was populated entirely by girls, but they were not doing what girls did when I was a kid. They were doing what boys did when I was a kid, in that they were having adventures, which was a thing girls were not supposed to have. They were swimming raging rivers and climbing mountains and learning to understand what animals did in the woods and on and on and on like that, except that their genders were flipped and except that I was one of them. So we were all girls on Girl Island.
One of the best things about talking to Sandy about controversial, difficult topics is her embrace of ambiguity. She's not the person who will tell you exactly the way the world works. In fact, as a founder of the field of gender studies, she won't even take a position on what it means to be transgender.
Now, we have very little medical evidence for how this works. Most trans women who have gone through it can only talk about it in terms of, this is what happened, this is valid because it was my experience. And ultimately, although I've started a field of study around this, and I have studied all the literature I can find about this, I don't have a better explanation at this point than that's the way I felt. So that's Girl Island, that's being 5 years old, that's trying to understand what transgender was. And this leads me to wonder about a statistic about which there isn't really enough evidence to know if it's real or not. But there's some data that seems to show that women who have been given diethylstilbestrol in their first semester of pregnancy tend to have kids who grow up to be more likely trans women. You notice I'm qualifying that a lot. Diethylstilbestrol was given as a way of reducing the possibility of miscarriage. It seemed to be effective for that. But then, as with thalidomide in another case, then this other statistic turned up later. So if you're looking for etiology, there's a possible one because I don't have any other one to offer you.
So what was your relationship with your mom like? Do you feel, looking back, that you had any different relationship with her than boys would have with their moms? Did you feel like that her being a woman made you had a different sense of your relationship to her?
No, that was not part of the feeling at all. I didn't feel any differently, as far as I know, toward my mother or toward my father. That was all fairly stereotypical, fairly standard. The only difference I can recall was they noticed that I wasn't behaving like the other boys my age. And they were worried that I might grow up gay. So they never said this, but in looking back on it, I can see that's what was going on with them. So they arranged for me to have an athletic coach who tried to teach me baseball and soccer and manliness is something, get out and play games and do all this. I never wanted to do any of that. And it was uncomfortable and painful for me to go through that, but I went through it and it didn't work. It didn't take. Eventually, I think I learned how to hit a ball sufficiently that they felt a little better about that. But it was clear that none of that ever really sank in.
So once you started going through puberty, when you're a little kid, like you pointed out, there's really no definition. I mean, we have cultural definitions of how boys and girls are. But when you let boys and girls be who they are, you just, of course, get the whole spectrum of behaviors and interests and boys who like dolls and girls who like baseball. And, you know, this is just the way people are. If you just let them be who they are, they tend to be who they are. But then we get puberty. And those hormones are strong. They affect not only how our body feels, but also how we feel emotionally and also how we start relating to each other. So talk a little bit about puberty and, you know, because you said that you felt like, you know, you had Girl Island. Were you still on Girl Island? Were those girls that were turning into women the same to you, or was there a change?
No, they kept growing up on Girl Island and they did go through puberty, and I conducted my sad, long fight with puberty, which I lost, and didn't quite know what to do about it. And I, there isn't very much I could say about that period beyond once your body starts to fight you in that way, then you have no choice but to retreat more and more into Girl Island, where things are fine all the time. That was one aspect of what was going on. The rest of it was just the reasonable rough and tumble of that age. I, as many people did, had a horrible high school experience, not because I was potentially trans or anything like that, but just because if one is geekly, high school can be a horrible place, and it was, and I had to deal with that. But that can also take your mind off potential trans issues, which it handily did. And so the teen years went on, but because I was a geek, I was doing normal geekly things at the same time, like building electronic devices and electromechanical devices and all sorts of things of that kind, chemical labs and things that we needn't digress into.
Were the girls on Girl Island like the girls you knew in high school, or were they different?
They were different. They were very much their own people, and that's a good question. They tended to be more direct, more willing to take risks. And this is merely my observation, mind you. Quieter, a lot more centered in themselves, And seeing the Barbie movie where the roles are reversed made me think back upon that, where Ken doesn't really have a good day unless Barbie looks at him. And I was thinking about how that was true for young women in, when I was in high school as well. In one way, they were very sure of themselves because they were growing breasts and getting hips, and they were aware right away that that affected the young men around them. But also there was all that focusing of attention on the young men. The young women in Girl Island didn't do that. They were there. They were very, very centered in who they were and in what they were doing. So that was a profound difference. It didn't necessarily have anything to do with the real world. But while I was on Girl Island, I was going, I really like what these people are doing. I want to be like them.
And I will get to this, but I think you sort of find them in real life. At the time, did you have any real world girlfriends? I mean, geek boys tend not to spend much time with girls back then because there weren't a lot of geek girls. But did you have any female friends?
Yes, I did. That was because I had artistic sensibilities, might be a good way to do it. So I tended to hang out with a few women who were also interested in performance art in the general sense, and one or two young men who felt the same way. I wouldn't call it a tight friendship, but it was definitely not being alone. There are a couple of independent factors that came together. One of them is that I was precocious. And consequently, I learned to read at a much, much earlier grade level than my colleagues, if you will, did. And I was an intense reader. I really wanted to do nothing else. My father, who was an attorney and also something of an intellectual, had a fairly extensive library for the time. And I made my way through the whole damn thing. Every book I could reach at my rather small height, I read. And that included a bunch of scholarly works and things that he used in his law practice, like Psychopathia Sexualis and The Sexual Question, of a very early book by Edward Forel, which at the time were the only textbooks that the legal profession had to go on. About sex offenders, and also happened to include the idea of earnings, you know, early term for homosexuality, and mentioned cross-dressing, of course, in a totally negative way, or loathsome behavior, and switched into Latin for the interesting parts. So I had to learn a little Latin in order to figure out what they were talking about. So by the time you get to the point where I'm having these interactions with these young women around puberty time, I've been through years of therapy and testing, and mostly testing to figure out why the hell I was so precocious and what was going on with me, you know, and what my IQ was, which turned out to be some horribly high number and doesn't mean anything in the real world, but threw everybody off. So this is all going on. So by the time I get there, I live in a different universe already. Transgender is like this maraschino cherry on this churning other thing that is my life at that point. I am confronting thing in column A, and thing in column B, and thing in columns C and D, and they're all going on while transgender is happening. And people tend to want the transgender thread, and that's fine. I can do that. But I do want you to understand, I haven't talked about this really, I want you to understand that that was not the only puzzling thing going on in my life. I had to deal with the fact that I didn't talk the way other people in my life talked. And I mean that. It wasn't just that the women were being reticent about being smart. We were a low-class Jewish neighborhood. We were going to a fairly good high school, but there were a lot of people playing catch-up. That's the milieu in which all of this is going on.
You probably know that my other area of study is that I'm an educator of gifted children. And I do know, and you probably know, that that there is a higher incidence of gender variation amongst higher IQ people. The other statistic that I would point out is that there was very possibly a highly gifted girl in that group who was hiding it.
I think that's very possible. For a while, I thought I had spotted her, in fact, but I'm not sure. I'm serious.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't really, and clearly your parents were in this camp because, you know, the age they were living in, don't really understand the difference between gender and sexuality. Mm-hmm. So at that point, were you feeling like you would be possibly a gay boy, or were you, what was your self-awareness as everyone starts to date and, you know?
I never thought I was a gay boy, but I believe there were gay boys who thought I was a gay boy. And that led to a lot of disappointment. And that remained true when I was engineering in mainstream rock in New York. There were a lot of men in the business who seemed to be convinced I was gay and who kept hating on me. And clearly, I was giving off some kind of signal, but I was unaware of what it was, and I kept going, "What's going on?" But I myself did not feel like a gay man at any time.
I've been speaking with pioneering activist, artist, and academic Sandy Stone about her childhood. When we return, she will find and leave a career before finding herself anew after a devastating accident.
You've been listening to The Balbory. We'll be back after this short break.
We're speaking with pioneering activist, artist, and academic Sandy Stone. At the time of this interview, a film about her successful and inspiring life is in production. But long before success, she was a confused boy, bruised by high school and her family's declining fortunes.
I had no interest in going to college whatsoever. After I got out of high school, I planted a little red flag in my mind that said, "You will never forget that this was the most unpleasant experience of your life. And you will never go back to education in any form."
Okay, Professor Stone, go ahead.
So I basically hung out and tried to figure out how to hold a job. And then it turned out I couldn't hold a job. After a while, I decided to throw in my lot with an undergraduate college.
Part of Sandy's early wanderings had to do with the fact that she didn't see herself in the world. I asked her what she saw when she looked at the women she knew at that time. Were they part of the image of womanhood that she had created on Girl Island?
No, not at all. My mother and her relatives were stereotypical Jewish housewives of the time. There was very little of the Jewish housewife model that I identified with. And the percentage, I think, would be zero if I were to think about it. The girls and then later the women in Girl Island had nothing to do with that. I did later meet real women, if you will, who were exactly like the women in Girl Island, but that came later.
So you eventually did find something. You found a career as a recording engineer.
In a state of utter Zen beginner's mind, I left Annapolis. I left with a typewriter case containing not a typewriter, but a change of underwear. And I went to New York. I opened the Yellow Pages to the first recording studio I saw in there, and I just went and knocked on their door and said, "I am the greatest recording engineer in the world," which of course was a lie. It was Gary Kellgren came to the door and looked me up and down and said, "Can you fix anything?" And I said, "Oh, sure, I can fix anything," which was partly true because I was a geek.
This part of Sandy Stone's story is a fascinating romp through the world of 60s rock and roll, from becoming Jimi Hendrix's recording engineer to Woodstock and more. But although fascinating, this was a period of time when Sandy was avoiding questions of her gender identity. A longer version of our conversation is archived on Babbelry.com in case you'd like to hear the details. For now, we take up Sandy's quest to find Girl Island in San Jose, California. Soon after attending Woodstock, Sandy had stepped off a chartered plane on the other side of the country. A friend had paid for the flight with a stolen credit card, and Sandy was coming off a days-long acid high with nothing but the clothes on her back, enough coins for a payphone, and the White Pages. She looked up an old college friend and got back on her feet, reestablishing her career in San Francisco.
So now I'm engineering in San Francisco. So now, to our point, now I have a time to think. So then I started poking around to find out if there were resources in San Francisco.
So you have time to think,
mm-hmm.
and you're still in this place where you hadn't had vocabulary for who you were, but now you're not amongst the Jewish housewives anymore, which I assume was...
a great step forward. Yes.
Yes. Because you could see more models of what a woman was.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that time and then how you got the information you needed.
I began thinking, I need to do something about finding out who I am and what I am and figure out some way to stop running away from things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was enormous fun and very profitable to run away from things, but it was beginning to annoy me. So I looked around for what could possibly help me.
Sandy found a place called the Transsexual Counseling Unit and met her first transgender woman, Jan Maxwell.
So I went down there, and here's Jan behind the desk, and she's very presentable, traditionally passable female woman, if I may. We had a brief conversation. I'm in my high male engineer's drag, engineer's boots, you know, this big black clunky leather thing, which is my rock and roll suit. And I say, I think I'm transsexual and I'm trying to explore more of what that means. And Jan said to me, "So you think you're transsexual? Come with me." She took me out of the office and down the street, and we went into one of the row houses in the Tenderloin, and we went down two or three flights of stairs, illuminated by red light bulbs in the ceiling. While we're going down, this is turning into this highly mythological moment with Jan leading me down into hell. And sure enough, that's where we go. We enter a room in which there are people sitting on the floor. There's no furniture. They are doing things like knitting or writing in journals. They are trans women who have started to transition and then, for one reason or another, gotten stuck by running out of money or energy or time or whatever. But after the second house, I go something like, "You're the transsexual counseling unit. Why aren't you helping these people? What are you doing to help them?" And Jan turns around to me, and her face is just absolutely blank. And she says, "I can't help them. Nobody can help them." And I said, "Well, why the hell are you showing me all this?" And she says, "Because I want to show you what's in store for you. This is going to be you, and you better get used to it."
Sandy ended up finding more information at a place called the Center for Special Problems, though again, she didn't quite find what she was looking for.
So I walk in and there's Angela Keys Douglas. Angela looks me up and down like a dead fish and goes, "So you think you're transsexual?"
Reflect on the transgender women that you had seen in that little misguided tour that you had.
Okay.
Can you explain what you saw when you saw those women and how you felt going? Because we're going to move on to your next steps. And what did you take away from that experience?
I took away that I had now met my first trans woman that I knew of. In some ways, she looked like a woman I might expect to pass on the street. But in other ways, she was totally crazy. And that meant she was not a role model for me. The only other trans women I met at that point in my life were the people Jan introduced me to in the basements of the Tenderloin. So from a very real point of view, I had no role models at all at that point. I must have had some kind of internal compass because I kept saying, "I think I am transsexual and I want to find out what that means." Mm-hmm. To me, these were people who had fallen out of the world and I did not want to fall out of the world. Fortunately, I don't have to think about it for at least a year. Because then I wind up in a hospital, flat on my back, and then a long time later in bed, not being able to move, and then for a while in a wheelchair, and then on and on.
A devastating accident left Sandy Stone hospitalized and in recovery for a year, during which time she wasn't able to explore her womanhood any further. She had gone from